live from across Europe. This is Previously in Europe, a podcast what was previously in Europe. I'm your co-host Hugh in London. I'm here with my lovely co-host Kieran in Berlin. Say hello, Kieran.
I live in the west part of Berlin, but it doesn't feel like it. That's what I'm thinking about right now.
What do you mean?
I don't know. I feel like we should have more money.
Right. Is the west part of Berlin the nice part? Like the expensive part?
Actually, no, it isn't, because mostly because the East Berlin was quite nicely built up and then was sold to a bunch of yuppies when the wall fell. So the west part is actually quite shitty in comparison.
Oh, I understand. Yes, right. Yeah. I guess I always think of it as like West Berlin was obviously West and East Berlin, there was a divide there, but I associate now that it's one city, that like maybe the south of Berlin is like the nice bit.
No, it's nothing like that.
Okay, yeah, it's still like a west-east divide. That's what you were.
Yeah. And like all the like East Berlin was the capital of the DDR, so like there's all these like nice apartments and houses for civil servants and stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, nice government buildings. Oh, no, I've been to Berlin. I just don't remember where the line is. I just get on a train and appear somewhere. It's a great thing about public transport.
Magical teleportation tubes. Yes.
Yeah. Similar to London, most people I know in London who have like left for pandemic reasons are just like, I do not know my way around anymore, because it's all based on really specific routes, or an app that will explain where you're going. And if you're listening to this on a podcast app, this is an app that explains where something we're going to talk about is going. This week on the podcast, as part of our recurring section, have you considered, where we consider a topic and then decide it is Matteo Renzi, Matteo Salvini, or actually good. Matteo Renzi being the ex-prime minister of Italy, who was kind of okay a bit. And then Matteo Salvini being the, right-wing...
former foreign minister.
Yeah.
Interior minister.
Yeah. Fascist former interior minister. Yeah. He didn't want to be foreign minister. That's too foreign for him.
He's now being charged for kidnapping.
Yeah, we'll talk about that another time. or actually good, if a thing is actually good. This week, I am going to try and argue the merits of the EU's MF and recovery deal. The MMF being the EU budget, and the recovery deal being the coronavirus recovery fund, which has been... It's been months. They've been talking about this for months.
Yeah, right.
So a couple of weeks ago, was this last week? This was basically, it was a week before last. The EU Council voted unanimously, because that was the required number of votes, for a package which was combining the MFF, MFF, not MMF, if I've been saying stupid. Anyway, and the recovery fund, as opposed to trying to negotiate them separately, which I think, to be fair, would have been a much bigger mess and would have just gone on even longer, rather than combining them. So what the money's come out at, the MFF is going to be about €1 billion in change, like 1.07.
In change, in 5-cent coins.
Sorry, trillion, not billion. Again, okay. It's hot here. It's very hot. And then the recovery fund is going to be €750 billion as an addition to the MFF. To put that in context, because big numbers are confusing, the actual spending for the EU in the previous MFF, so the EU does 5-year plans, much like Mussolini's fascist dictatorship. Yes. So they do five-year plans effectively, to basically, otherwise they'd have to have unanimous agreement between all the member states every couple of years or something. Instead, they do it every 5 years, which I think is relatively reasonable. This is very comparable to what the actual spending of the EU was in the previous MFF. However, to put that like in context, there's that therefore there's no inflationary rise.
Oh, good.
For instance, and there's been a rejigging around of some things that the EU wanted to move focus to is coming out at the expense of some other things, and then some other things are becoming more expensive anyway. So, for instance, one of the big, like the actually the biggest bit of the EU's budget is the Common Agricultural Policy, which is both a regulatory mechanism and also a subsidies mechanism for making sure the EU has enough food. but it makes up like $336 billion out of this budget, and that has gone up from the total like euro amount previously, because they're not cutting anything from it. In fact, they're adding some things to it. And then some of the coronavirus fund is also a top up to the Common Agricultural Policy, because like, to be fair, as you would expect, you know, food production, while has been still needed, like food distribution pipelines have been heavily disrupted, and ensuring they all still exist is an important thing to be spending money on. But that's a small part of the $750 billion. Most of it is money that is going semi-directly to member states. So what they've agreed on is €312 billion are going to be in grants. So that is effectively money that the EU is giving to these countries that they don't need to pay back. It's not a loan from the EU. It's a contribution from the EU to that country. And then the rest, there's another €360 billion available directly to countries in loans, which they can apply for from the EU, which, you know, isn't great. So the original pitch, so when we discussed the like original pitches on the podcast before, and our consensus effectively was the Parliament wanted $2 trillion, if I'm remembering that correctly. Germany and France came to an agreement that was a lot worse. I forget exactly what it was. Was it like
one?
What? One.
No, you're right. Sorry, the Commission wanted $1 trillion, the Parliament wanted $2 trillion, and Germany and France, I think, were like $750 billion or something like that.
Yeah, it's quite similar to what we've ended up with.
Yeah, nice.
So the Commission's proposal was for more money, and then, like, the caveat that they didn't, like, stick specific numbers to this, but the caveat generally was that they wanted most of this being grants, because from the financial crash, the consensus for most sane people,
yes,
who aren't Schwarzenegger cultists,
important caveat there, I guess.
Yeah, most sane people, or and like a reasonable consensus of economists, that the bailout funds from the financial crash in Europe didn't produce the kind of recovery that people wanted it to, and having an alternative to you owe the EU money, and therefore the EU can like take your money away if you don't do exactly what they say, which will be austerity. Having an alternative to that in some form is probably quite good, and that is sort of what this intends to deliver. Going into this, basically, like the depending on what like whether or not this was a good deal for for what the Commission wanted, or for the frugal countries, quote unquote, will depend on like what news outlet you're looking at. So like a lot of places have tried to sell this as Commission loses big in what they wanted, because they've been forced to accept that more than half the money is in loans rather than grants. And other people trying to sell it as like, oh, this is Merkel and Macron had a big loss here. They had to like concede a lot, isn't untrue, but I think they often skim over that the negotiating position going into something, like they all acknowledge they're not going to get exactly what they wanted, and like the Netherlands negotiating position was, we want no grants at all, and they have a sort of good reason for this, which I think is well articulated by a few economists around the place, which is, this doesn't explain how they're going to pay back the grants. So the EU at some point has to pay back the grants, because the way they're getting the money, like they're raising the money on like the bond market. So like, while modern monetary theory people would I think correctly argue that they don't really have to pay the money back in like real terms, but like on paper, the way they have to pay the money back is by, you know, raising money somehow at some point. But they haven't actually introduced a mechanism to do that, and that was something that like was kind of being pushed around, which was some introducing some more taxation powers for the EU. So, like, a digital sales tax would be one way you could do that, as, like, a way of the EU bringing in some money. So they do it now by import duties on things that the EU controls. And I think that's the... Hamilton fans like to call this a Hamiltonian leap.
Damn it. I hate this.
I know, Val. And I think that, like, the main argument against that is, one, the scale of this is not kind of what you would expect from, you know, forming a nation stuff. But it also doesn't do, like, what the core thing other than be able to raise money on the financial markets, you also need to be able to raise revenue as well as that, because raising debt doesn't make sense if you've no, like, money generating aspect as well. It needs to be, like, a balancing act to figure out how much money you need to raise versus how much debt you're allowed to raise. Whereas if you've no way of raising the money other than asking the EU countries that won't agree to give you more money in the future to, like, in theory pay this back, then it doesn't really make sense. So, like, there's effectively, like, if this ends up definitely happening, then there may be some sort of move in the future, maybe more quietly, to bring in some sort of taxation method, which might be, like, a carbon tax, something else. Like, they're not gonna have, like, EU income tax. That's not, like, not realistic. But doesn't they need to raise money somehow? What's your general feel about this?
The there's no money, basically.
No, like the thing overall, like, from a big picture perspective. Like, when you heard there was, like, a quote-unquote deal, what was your like, sentiment? Was it, like, I actually don't care because it's not enough money to matter?
Yeah.
Or
yeah, that was basically it, yeah. Because, like, as soon as I heard the whole, like, there's a deal, I was like, no, there isn't. Shut up. Stop us. This is annoying. Go away. Yeah, like, this is, as you said, the amount of spending is very similar from previous years. They've just kind of, like, rejigged things around and where money is going. Rather than, like, probably what you would want or expect during, like, a moment of crisis, which is a large increase in the budget. And this is also going to be for the next 5 years. Yeah. So, like, we won't really get a chance to talk about this again until, what, 2025?
Yeah.
So that's cool. By then, I expect, like... Italy to be various warring principalities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the best scenario.
Yeah. So I guess, like, the total amount of money being doled out by the EU has gone up. Like, so it's going up by the amount of the recovery fund. So, like, the EU's normal, like, operating budget is effectively unchanged at about a trillion euro, which sounds like a lot of money, but for what the EU does, it's not that much money, considering how much of it is agricultural subsidies and regulation.
And the amount of, like, scope the EU is meant to have, like, a continent.
Yeah.
Most of a continent that has, like, 700 million people in it. No, 500 million, sorry.
Yeah. But so, the recovery fund is an enormous total increase on the budget, if you counted it as part of the budget, which in sort of an effect it is, because it is money that effectively a country applies for, and they, like, so the way they're doling it out, which I think is semi-reasonable, so they're using GDP change this year versus last year is how they're going to do it, which I think is probably, like, GDP is not a good measure of, you know, stuff in general, of like quality of life in a country or anything. But for this perspective, which is your country's spending power in your national budget is likely to change by roughly this percentage due to there being less economic activity in your country. So, like, I mean, Italy getting, like, you know, tens of billions more in their budget to spend on like infrastructure and other things that would be beneficial to Italy, to specifically targeting sectors that have been badly hit by this, for instance, like some sort of bailout for the tourism industry perhaps could be, you know, used via this. There is a substantial total euro amount. It's just whether or not it's not going into normal EU spending. It means the EU is like they've had to cut like EU-wide programs. It's more they've created a fund that is guaranteed from a debt perspective by all of the countries instead of one of the countries, and therefore like Italy can get money that is backed by Germany to an extent. So it's kind of redistributive, but the national governments have control over what they spend it on.
Yeah, so there's an aspect there of like trusting the national governments to do what is needed, which some of these countries I probably do. I think Italy will spend money with good intentions. I'm not sure if they will spend it on the right things, but they'll spend it on the like weird kind of like public-private partnership technocratic nonsense that they probably think will help the country. I guess the thing about all this is I just find it very, very underwhelming. It is definitely not the Hamiltonian moment. Because I guess like what that, because we were joking that this is like the term being used because of the musical being on Disney Plus now. But like this is in reference to the United States basically at its foundation mutualizing its debt. So like, you know, the debt incurred by the state of West Virginia, well, West Virginia didn't exist by then, Virginia, would also, like, could be paid for by, or covered by New York.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, I guess the annoying thing about that comparison is that was established as a rule rather than this, which seems to establish it as, like, in an emergency time.
Yeah, as an exception,
because like if that's how the EU operated full time, that might be a little bit better. It would probably, yeah, it would work a lot better than it currently does, because you would have situations where, yeah, but then you would also need fiscal transfers, which we don't really have a system for either, but the US does, I think, technically.
Well, yeah, so I think what I find quite a compelling argument about this, that it formalizes what, so the ECB does quantitative easing, so they do bond buying of they buy national debt in order to like allow these countries that don't have their own currency anymore due to the euro to like raise money via the ECB effectively, and this like effectively like formalizes an agreed time where they've agreed to do this on a scale that's way, way bigger than what the ECB was doing. And I think it normalizes it, which is, I think, predominantly a good thing, because it, while I, like, I'll get into it in a second, that like a big problem with the grants, it does effectively normalize what is, in this case, not like the wealth transfer. If we talked about this in, say, last year, where we'd be arguing for the EU to continue to like actually work the way that people like to think it does, they would need to set up some sort of fiscal transfer kind of setup where and like via some programs this does happen, and I guess like us being from Ireland is relatively good example of this, where a lot of Ireland's infrastructure as we know it was like effectively subsidized by the EU, so there's like a wealth transfer thing going on. It's just not on the scale that would, you know, change things very, very quickly or have things on an impact in a much larger country. Like, so like this will happen slower in Poland, it's a bigger country, but kind of once you get this stuff in place, it's then very difficult to unstick. So like once you have the mechanism and all of the bureaucracy that goes with setting up a system where, oh, this is just what the ECB does now, and it becomes a lot more difficult to make the argument that we've talked about before, that a lot of German conservatives are trying to make with their, in my opinion, very frivolous lawsuit against the ECB for quantitative easing. Like this normalizes this on a on a very, very large scale, and it makes it much more difficult to argue against any time there's an economic problem going on to just, you know, do some version of this again, because there's no reason we can't do it. Effectively, it is just moving stuff around on spreadsheets. It's not super realistic. And otherwise, like, the EU just doesn't work at all. It doesn't do any of what it promises it does. Whereas, I feel like at least in this way, it does some reasonable amount of it, because it's not just redistributing money using the smaller programs it has, and I guess to some extent the common agricultural system. But like, this does it on a scale that is basically just, here is money, you figure out what would be useful for your economy to prevent it from collapsing, which seems good.
Yeah, I guess my reaction is probably always just a frustration at how slow even this came to happen, because like the best argument you can do is like, oh, this is compelling, or this is like setting the groundwork for a standard.
Yeah.
Right? Now that's good, and it's possibly true, but it's also fairly flimsy, as like, they could, like, this could establish it doing it in the future more often, and like, it could, but could also not. And also, they could just completely disregard it when things are good again and they go back to the mantra of like austerity. So yeah, like, it's like, if that's the best we can hope for here, that's kind of grim. I mean, it's like, it should just have been the case of just like, here's huge swaths of money, and we got the fiscal transfer thing sorted out a million years ago, and yeah, like, everything about like neutralizing debt and providing money, and even the like EU subsidy thing for public transport or infrastructure is great. It's like pretty darn good propaganda as well. It like came up a lot in the Brexit debate, of just like the EU flags attached to various signs saying this train was paid for by, but like, they're usually part subsidies. The payment for a lot of these projects also comes from other sources. Like, a lot of the stuff in Ireland where like it was partly funded by the EU was also partly funded by either the Irish government or some sort of horrible like weird failure of a private company that we decided owns the like Lewis now in perpetuity. Like, it's always like these very, very half measures.
Yeah,
and like dipping your toe in, being like, oh, wouldn't it be nice in the future if we could do this? And it'd be like, no, it'd be nice if you could do it now. That'd be great.
Yes, but you know what they can't?
Well, the other grim side of it as well is just like, if you can't or won't do it now, like, when the hell are you going to do it? Because like, I don't know if anyone's noticed, but 2020's been a hell of a year.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's very difficult to, but like, because of the scale of this being unimpressive and not doing like what people think would actually be necessary, I think that does overshadow what is like otherwise very, very large shift in conceptually how the EU funds things at all. Like, the EU being able to raise money directly through bonds to then give that back to governments, like, is a big structural change, and like, it would have been very unlikely to happen in any other circumstance. While that's very unimpressive and has come with a lot of like bad caveats and things that have meant it doesn't really work, and it's definitely not to the scale that anyone, like, I think anyone reasonable would have argued, me implying there's a lot of unreasonable people at the negotiating table of this, but this is unfortunately what you get when you have like, you have to come to a consensus between like Mark Rutte and Spain's government.
Yeah, I mean, the Dutch have been absolutely ugh during this whole thing.
Yeah, and it's not just the Dutch. Like, as in, there's a lot of like very, very conservative, especially fiscally conservative people, running countries in the EU. And yes. I think one like the thing about I think in a lot of English language media, Mark Rutte getting attention for being like, oh, a fiscal stickler on the EU budget is actually, that should be massively overshadowed by him being a massive prick in his own country about the pandemic generally, and being like, aggressively resisting any like thing, anything that would have any modicum of economic impact, regardless of how dangerous it was. And like, that's unfortunately the problem with when you form a union of like actually autonomous countries, and you do try and keep them relatively autonomous, and then you have to have consensus driven stuff. It's unfortunate that this has come at a time when there's some like very conservative people going on, like Kurz in Austria is like,
yeah,
you know, quite extreme in a lot of ways, and then, you know, there's Orban, etc.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because like there'll be different sides of this, like Orban and the Polish parties aren't really fiscally conservative, but they'll want the money to come from the EU in such a way that it's not obvious it came from the EU, for like internal propaganda reasons. But like, I think you're more concerned with like, I'm more concerned with things like the Irish government, you're right, like Kurz and Mark Rutte as well are also fairly fiscally conservative. That's part of their brand almost. But like, the other thing that gets shown is like, we're only really seeing support from like the southern economies because they're the ones doing poorly. Like supposedly left wing or center left governments that aren't doing poorly at the moment have also been quite fiscally conservative. The response from Finland has been like very disappointing.
That's Finland's brand of.
Yeah,
social
sure,
democracy
sure.
is like yeah. a protect, but also protect Finnish interests while you're at it.
Yeah.
But I mean, like this is the thing. I think it's quite complicated to how we got here, because like objectively, like Merkel and Macron's plan was better than this, and like you could argue that like, oh, they needed a stronger like initial plan. Their plan was like weak sauce generally, but like I think it is quite notable that like. The current German government is proposing something like far more reasonable than what like the Irish government would put forward.
Oh god, yeah, it's a very weird moment.
And I think that's general. The thing is the very weird moment and weird dynamics have resulted in both something that is not like not good enough for the actual like pandemic, but then again, the EU is not set up to deliver something quickly anyway. However, it is like a big structural change that would have taken like a new generation of leader of heads of government and like the political tides in multiple countries to have shifted for it to otherwise have happened. And like we were gearing up to what seemed like, you know, growing resistance to the entire idea of the ECB raising like buying national debt in the first place. And now it's changing to, oh, maybe it's okay if we raise money at the EU level. We'll talk about how we'll like pay for it later in terms of like a other side of the balance sheet kind of discussion, which is like a very different position to have ended up in. And I think it's an objectively better position to have ended up in. It's just not, I agree, it's not what it says. And I think there was an article which I can't find immediately, but it was written by two Belgian youth climate activist people in Politico, which effectively was just like, it's really insulting to call this, I forget what they're calling it new next generation EU is what they're calling the recovery plan. That's its branding, and they're effectively like, very rightly, they're just effectively saying this doesn't move us in a direction where you can like make any of those kind of claims. It's very misleading and insulting to imply that you're like, oh, we're doing a big leap forward, And it's much less sexy to be like, we've made big structural changes. Because actually, the people who don't like this, that would scare them a lot more.
Yeah, the Catholic Church, we've made some changes.
Yeah, basically. I think it's just... like changing the funding model of the EU and like these structural changes that are like super boring and actually will make very little short term impact. The recovery fund will have an effect on lessening the like massive economic fallout that will come from like whenever your European economies can properly reopen, because like a lot of places are, you know, re-shutting down or like selectively shutting down now anyway. So I think, as we don't know how bad this is going to be in total, and so like the 750 billion will remain a drop in the bucket, in an ever-growing bucket, but yeah. I think the structural movement is a big deal, and like as you said, we're not effectively, if this budget passes the parliament, we're not going to get to talk about this for 5 more years. So this kind of structural change being built into the budget, even though the budget is a bit shit, is quite a big deal. As I mentioned at the budget itself, I really liked Scott Keller, who's head of the Green EFA party in the European Parliament. Is she joint head? Do they do the Green Party joint head thing? Yeah, so she's one man, one woman. Yeah. I liked her tweet. I think her tweet was a good summation. I think is part of my argument, which is the good news that there is a deal. The list of bad news is long. Cuts to the health and climate programs, which I think are the first, is very ironic because cutting the like cross border health promotion budget at this time is hilarious. Not more than vague words on rule of law, which we haven't discussed. I guess we could discuss very briefly. Cuts in the long-term budget, not to forget the poisoned atmosphere. EU Commission. Hashtag EU Commission. Hashtag recovery fund.
Yeah.
I think this is the thing, is that like the budget has been cut, but I went back and read a bunch of the articles I had originally put aside to reread whenever we discuss the EU budget, because like they've been negotiating this for 6 months. I liked Mario Monti had an article in Politico. Mario Monti, people oh, there's no reason you should remember Mario Monti. Former Italian prime minister. He was kind of like the, when Berlusconi was finally taken down due to his many many crimes, Mario Monti was installed as this like technocratic kind of guy to kind of like get Italy out of the economic crash, and then he became very unpopular for all of the things he did. Do you remember anything else about Mario Monti? That's what I remember about him.
I have nothing on Mario Monti. I'm sorry, he's a cool kind of name.
Yeah, he's a cool name. He was aggressively dull and then unpopular person. But effectively, like he had an article that, like, the headline of which was "Don't let the frugals rule the budget," because this was the concern before there was any coronavirus, was that the quote unquote frugal four countries would try and cut the budget really heavily, and they would, based on the argument that the UK is leaving, so that you need to take their contribution off the budget immediately, regardless of anything else, and then on top of that, due to like economic problems due to that, we want to cut the budget more. And effectively he was like, you'd be missing like an opportunity to massively increase the budget and like do some structural change to the EU, for instance, like dealing with the some form of border security, some sort of like coordination on defense if the US is just going to ignore NATO. You could spend like not focus so much on like who pays in more to the budget and who gets out of the budget, just kind of like figure out what's good for actual common goals, like which would be like better uses of EU money, rather than people constantly arguing being like, we paid in slightly more than we got out this time. And you're like, that's all reasonable. Like, obviously I don't agree with Mario Monti on a lot of stuff, but you know, it's kind of and a lot of this is about like structural like dealing with populism vagueness, but it's effectively like a lot of his worst fears and like happened, but not to the extent that he thought that he was worried they would happen. Like the cuts to the budget aren't like not they're not good, but they're not like massive slashes to the budget, and they've also got like a recovery fund out of it. So you know, I think the budget could have ended up being much worse. And
oh yeah, of course.
Actually, if there was no pandemic, I think the budget would have been worse.
Yes, yeah, it seemed to be going that direction.
Especially because I think if there was no pandemic, you wouldn't have got Germany on board with semi-status quo. I think they would have been on the side of let's cut some money out of it.
Yeah, there's some like posturing or like some kind of general beliefs that this is retired, this is like lame duck Merkel.
Yeah,
that maybe this would have happened anyway, even if the pandemic was there, or like maybe not to the same extent, but something similar might have happened because. Yeah, we're now kind of the German media kind of interpretation is we're now seeing a more ideological Merkel rather than a Merkel that's doing what she thinks she needs to do in order to appease her party.
What is more ideological Merkel? Is it let's spend money and do redistribution in the EU?
Yeah, like she that's the idea. I'm not sure how much I believe that, but yeah. Yeah, because like anything like what you could say about Merkel, at least, and what I do agree with is she believes in the EU as a project.
Yeah,
and if she sees that as the way of saving it, she'll do it. Recently, she is, as much as I don't like Merkel or the CDU, she is the left wing of her party. Like the problem the problem Germany's kind of running into now with anyone who might replace her is that they're all very much worse than her, and people don't like who could be a potential successor to her because her as a person within the party is actually kind of an oddity. They haven't really been able to find, you know, the Merkel clone who can come in. And there doesn't seem to be, because all these people who are like potentially going to be his successors are like to the further to the right, more believe in Schwarze Null, but are maybe willing to adopt the kind of like more social policies of the AfD, which historically were like the right wing of the CDU, especially during like West Germany time. So that's kind of like the alternative that's being posited in within the CDU, and there is support within the CDU for that. So like I kind of do believe the idea that a lot of what Merkel has done has been appeasing the party that she maybe doesn't necessarily agree 100% with.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if this what her exact ideology would be, what ideological Merkel is, and whether it's what we're seeing now.
Yeah. This is my point about like the slow moving, like the EU is very much designed to be very slow moving in that like one, you need consensus on everything, but also like in the round of one of these budgets, like things can shift massively in individual countries. Like I think it's relatively notable that someone of Merkel's like what are allegedly Merkel's like core beliefs wouldn't join the CDU now. Probably because their local party wouldn't agree with them on most things, especially if they were like in the CSU down south, realistically, and like most of the people around Merkel. I think von der Leyen is probably a good example of this, like how she was neither popular enough public, like in the public, nor was it seemingly that she was actually popular enough within her party. Because she seems like a more Merkel-y character, but, you know, doesn't, maybe is more incompetent. I don't know. There's very reasons people didn't like her. I wanted to correct something. The MFF isn't 5 years. It's 2021 through 2027. So it's longer than that.
Yeah, I remember this now. Sorry. Yeah, I remember thinking, why is it so out of sync with the like new
the elections,
EU government? Yeah, because the EU government is effective every 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's strange.
No, the MFF is separate. I think that's intentional to...
Yeah, it kind of separates the EU government from being in any way like in budgetary control.
Yep.
Ugh.
Yeah, but I mean, like, this has synced up relatively closely with an election. So I guess we can talk about that briefly. That David Sassoli, the head of the EU Parliament, has effectively said, in its current state, I'm rejecting this.
Right. Yeah.
Which, you know, may or may not come to anything. There was a note I'd written on, like, our original. before the pandemic, when I was like taking notes on this, which was just David Sassoli is toothless because he has no teeth. it was because there was
solid political assessment, Hugh.
Yeah, no, it was because there was this article, was the title of which was Parliament's EU budget strategy: go big, then go home. Which effectively was because David Sassoli was just publicly saying everyone else's statements on the budget, if that's what they come out with, I'm rejecting it. he didn't really have, like, you know,
doesn't have power.
Yeah, like, he, like, as in, the problem of the EU Parliament is that, like, because it's made up of representatives of parties in the constituent countries, effectively, like, if something is important enough to a national party, the MEPs of that party aren't going to be loyal to, like, say, if you're in the Social Democrats, you're not going to be loyal to David Sassoli. You're going to be loyal to your local party first. If you're in Italy and David Sassoli is, well, actually, that's a bad example because David Sassoli is Italian. If you're in Macron's party, and this is like Macron's name is all over this deal, and the head of Renew Europe is like, we're rejecting this because it doesn't go far enough on these climate goals we have. In practice, a lot of the MEPs aren't going to vote with the bigwigs in the EU Parliament party are saying. I think that's effectively the people's opinion on David Sassoli. There's also funny, one of the other lines I really liked in this is, diplomats have long regarded the Parliament's demands as something of a joke.
Yes.
Which you know, checks out. Their rhetoric on this has been kind of more measured, because I think they acknowledge that as I've been trying to argue, but like semi pretty unconvincingly, I think, in this episode so far, that like this is a reasonably good deal compared to like what the options were, which were nothing or this,
or they'd all be loans.
Yeah, or it'd be much worse than this. Or like, the budget would have much deeper cuts. It's something that I expected the budget to have much deeper cuts than this, even though it's still not great. I think their position has been more measured. And they have quite specific problems with it, and it's kind of down to, like, again, as Scott Keller said, it's down to specific programs that have been cut in the budget, and effectively they would, you know, if the total number is not negotiable, that's not the way people in the parliament would cut it, because the parliament is representative in a way the council is not. But the council is the heads of government of all the constituent countries, whereas the parliament is a proportional representation distribution of political power. So like the Greens are quite a substantial political force, and the Social Democrats are quite a substantial political force, and like EPP is a mixed bag, etc. And there's a left in the parliament that hates this, like dead on arrival kind of level. So kind of like you do need to make some changes to appease the Greens potentially. But I think they kind of generally acknowledge that this is a much bigger recovery deal than anyone expected. They've also made comments around the rule of law thing, which we haven't really discussed, which effectively is there was talk going into the council that they were going to have the other bad thing I haven't talked about in this is that you need to present like a budget plan to the EU Commission to get your money. So all the countries need to do that, and basically people are like, this is just another way of doing austerity, because like the Netherlands is going to veto whatever whatever Spain asks for,
the final approval thing.
And on top of this as well, they wanted originally, like quite a few countries in the EU wanted a similar veto on, basically, they were effectively wanted a mechanism where they could say to Hungary and Poland, you need to stop your court packing garbage and questionable reforms, or else no money. And they didn't get that through. They got like a really vague wording thing that Orban declared victory over, but then concurrently on the same day, von der Leyen said that it had loads of rule of law stuff in it, so it's not...
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah. It's, the dance continues between the EU as an institution and the Fidesz/PIS government.
Yeah, so it's the... Yeah, so it's the parliament kind of want more of that, but that's definitely not going to happen. Whether or not they get minor concessions over, like, a few billion here or there on individual programs in the EU budget is, I think, up for debate, but I think in practice this will probably go through at some point. The Parliament press release on their like plenary session on it effectively is just like, it's positive, but we don't like the cuts.
Huh?
And they're basically also like, we want like the Parliament to get sign off on things, which again they may or may not get, but it's they're not going to get the rule of law stuff.
No, of course not, in any way that would actually allow them to enact it or enforce it.
Yeah, but David Sassy just has no teeth. He's just a glasses man.
Yeah,
moving his paper around his desk.
Failed attempt to be mayor of Rome.
Yeah,
he didn't lose to the fridge woman. She came later, I think.
She did come later. That was later. Failed mayoral candidate David Sassoli, who's now in charge of the EU Parliament. In the same way, Ursula von der Leyen is a failed chancellor candidate who is now head of the EU Commission.
Shuffled away.
Yeah, both failed upwards. But I think the people, so any of the people in the CDU who wanted to get rid of von der Leyen are probably really annoyed that they did that right now, because in practice, they put her in charge of a lot more money than they intended to.
Who knows? I think the everything about the EU screams failing upwards. It's just like everyone who's in a position of power within the EU.
Yeah, well, I mean, Charles Michel as well. I had something else to say on this. I don't know what it was. I'm watching my notes. It seems like I've said everything. that's fine. So if you were to rate this Mario, or actually good, how do you feel about the EU big deal? Or if you've any other like general comments. Have I caused you to have a more positive view of this?
No. I mean, like, compared to the fictitious alternative that could have been a lot worse, sure, but like, I could always imagine a worse situation. I'm just that kind of person.
I think me and Mario Monti are trying to say that wasn't fictitious. That was a real possibility.
Yeah, but so many things are a real possibility. It's history now, so now it's done. I guess like there's the huge problems I have with it is just like, I don't feel like it's enough money. We've kind of like boxed away this conversation, or they'll attempt to box away this conversation for another 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
At which point, like, there's a real opportunity. There's like a real possibility. If we're not talking about real possibilities, a real possibility that Italy might leave the Eurozone or the EU.
Yeah.
And this, in my opinion, does next to nothing to prevent that. And with that in mind, like, that's kind of, that could be the end of the EU or the Eurozone or both.
Uh-huh.
Because Italy is this massive economy. It's very symbolic of the European project being one of the founding members. And like a huge, like, despite all the talk of the Dutch, like within Dutch media of like, oh, we do all the work in Europe and everyone south of Switzerland is incredibly lazy.
Yeah.
Like, no, Italy has a massive manufacturing base and like is a home to some of the like world's monopolies and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I doesn't approve of them being monopolies, but like still.
The Netherlands is a tiny country and the amount of attention that Margherita gets is reasonable.
Congratulations on Unilever, I guess. But like, but yeah,
didn't Unilever announce they were moving their headquarters to London instead?
Sure, exactly. Where are you now, Netherlands?
yeah.
But like, Yeah, so for that reason, I actually want to give this a Matteo Salvini. In a
all right,
unless he's arrested for like all his hijinks, he could be in power soon, and this doesn't do anything to stop that. Polling for Italy doesn't look good.
No. No, it doesn't. Yeah, Unilever are moving their headquarters to London.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so what do you got left? Royal Shell Company? Great.
Yeah, that's oil has taken a big hit in this pandemic.
Yeah, oil will always go up.
Oh, no. you're giving us Matteo Salvini. Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I don't... My conceptual idea of this episode, in a similar way, the conceptual idea a lot of people had for the recovery fund was that I would have some like core good arguments as to why this is good. And the more I looked into it, the more a lot of my core arguments didn't pan out. In a similar way to the recovery fund's smallness, not in a surprising way, but in a way that was like, oh yeah, well that's obviously the case with these reasons.
Yeah.
I think I will give this a actually good, because I'm all for structural changes. and in some way, you can view this as a $750 billion increase to the EU budget. You'd be wrong to make that assertion, but it's an assertion you could make. And some people might assume that was the case. Actually, you know what? If the UK was not leaving the EU, that is exactly the headline that would be happening in British tabloids at the moment. Oh. People would be saying they're doubling the EU budget, and people would be like, oh, you're not technically doubling it. It's actually more like a 75% increase. And the Sun wouldn't take that. They'd be like, we need to leave now. We need to have another Brexit referendum because, you know, we had the first one in the good times, and it's now coronavirus times, the EU is terrible, they've doubled the budget.
What a counterfactual that would be. The UK is still in the EU during the fucking coronavirus pandemic.
Imagine the budget then.
Yeah.
Be a bad budget.
25 shillings. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm bumming myself out because I'm looking at the polling data of Italy at the moment.
Well, you know.
There's some recent polls that have Fratelli d'Italia as the third largest party, beating Five Stars.
Yeah, for people who really don't remember, Fratelli d'Italia is the party that has, like, Mussolini's descendants in it.
Yes.
And they run proudly with Mussolini as their name, and it makes them more popular, not less popular.
Yeah.
So I think no, this is naturally good. It's a Matteo Renzi. It's what was available.
It's a Salzi. It's a Renzvini.
Yeah, but you know, I just wanted to manufacture some good news out of this. I think overall, it's like it's not an actively bad thing.
It's a big win for the EU's paper supplier.
Oh yeah, good. But budget's gonna be thick.
Good job, team.
Yeah, I mean, there was going to be a budget. We were gonna talk about it anyway at some point. And you know, frankly, this is better than the budget I expected.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's sure. Yeah,
I'm taking that as a win.
I'm just so jaded.
Yeah, pandemic has had an effect on morale.
Oh, of course. And on that happy note, that was another episode of Previously in Europe. Previously in Europe is recorded and produced by Hugh O'Brien and Kieran Dold. If you like the show, tell your friends about it, because word of mouth is actually really important. You could also leave a review 4 or 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Just leave a review 4 or 5 stars with some comments, some nice words, and that also appeases the podcasting gods. Lastly, if you want to support us, one of the best ways you can do that is on patreon.com/previouslyineurope. There you can donate some money to keep the podcasting lights on and get some bonus goodies. In return for your support, if you donate $3 or more, to as a monthly subscription fee, we shout your name out on the podcast like these cool cats. Smeiro, Echo 2100, Svenvest, Petra V, Patrick Seba, Newt Alexander, Michael Hall, Dreers Arian, Niall McLaughlin, Subliminal Kid, Dermot Burke, and Justin Paul Sammons. So if you want to be like those cool kids, send us some money to help keep the podcast going. Lastly, you can find all of our social media. We're kind of all over the place. And all information and new episodes and stuff like that at previouslyineurope.eu. Previouslyineurope.eu. Thanks for listening.